From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Chad Post's publishing company, Open Letter Books, is dedicated to capturing the spirit and the style of poetry and prose from around the world.
There's something that makes the original work unique and makes the voice work, makes the plot work, makes everything works because there's something unique about how it's written. And it's a translator's job to capture that and replicate that.
Today, we start a month-long series about international literature. But first, Joshua Landis joins me to discuss the latest on the ceasefire in Syria and the future of the country's civil war.
The rebels are left alone, facing an Assad regime that they need to find a way to surrender to. The problem is, Assad isn't going to accept the surrender. The war is going to go on.
That's all coming up after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Joshua Landis, it's the first week of the new year, and we have to obviously go back to the Middle East because, you know, recently you reported that there was a ceasefire in Syria. You were a bit, let's say, less than optimistic about at the time. But the big news being that Turkey had signed on to the ceasefire, kind of brokered the ceasefire. But the fact is, it's already falling apart. And it's very complicated signing a ceasefire, getting all of these different players in Syria, all these different rebel groups at the table to hold a ceasefire. So give us the context, the lay of the land here, because it already seems to not be working.
You're right. It is falling apart. President Assad essentially has promised that he's going to take back all of Syrian land. And Turkey's joining this ceasefire is really a statement that they're not going to support the rebels anymore. That their joint statement with Russia was ultimately very bad news for the rebels. So the rebels are left alone facing an Assad regime that they need to find a way to surrender to. The problem is, Assad isn't going to accept the surrender of a lot of these guys, particularly the more jihadist members. Assad wants them to flee the country, or he's going to come and kill them. And that's the dilemma. So probably, you know, more than 50% of Syrian territory is held by rebels. That's including ISIS, which has the lion's share. But there are lots of little bits elsewhere that our rebel territory. They're going to the war is going to go on, and there are over 1,000 of these rebel groups. 7 of them signed on to the ceasefire. It was aspirational. Everybody understood that it wasn't going to hold, and that Assad is going to push forward. And that these rebels have little choice: either they can flee into Turkey, which doesn't want them, or they stand and fight.
So the ceasefire initially really was just a signal from Turkey that they weren't going to support them anymore. And it wasn't anything more than that. I mean, and what about the United States? The United States has since actually dropped bombs on rebel territory
absolutely
there as well. So, you know, what signal is that sending?
Well, absolutely. The United States is pounding ISIS territory, which is the vast majority of rebel territory. Of course, they're not included in this. Neither is al-Qaeda. And the United States just bombed and killed 30 al-Qaeda officials, some of them senior officials, that the United States suspects is planning attacks on the West. So the U.S. is flying over the skies of Syria bombing things, and so is Assad and the Russians. So it's very difficult to know who is where, who is a signatory to this, because jihadist groups are marbled throughout the rebel territory.
Well, you mentioned Assad promising that he was going to take back all of Syria's land. I mean, you mentioned in a recent program that Assad has effectively won this civil war because the fact that that these rebel groups are no longer going to get the support that they once had, perhaps. But he's still going to have to fight them to get this land back, right? I mean, it's not like they're going to just hand it back to him. So the civil war continues. Like you said, the civil war will go. In other words, the war will go on. The violence will go on.
There is no political agreement between rebels and Assad. That's the problem. And the rebels, many of them, particularly the most Salafist ones, want Sharia law, some form of an Islamic state. Assad, who is accused of not being a Muslim, and many of the other religious minorities don't want any of that. They're not going to have an Islamic state, which would make them second-class citizens. And they're completely stubborn. They see these rebels as traitors. They call them cockroaches and other horrible words. So it's not a situation where there is a political solution that you could say, geez, everybody's going to put down their guns and they're going to figure out how to live together.
So we've got a few more days until Trump is inaugurated as president. Any changes that you expect immediately from Trump becoming president? Assad being emboldened, Russia being emboldened, Turkey obviously backing off. Anything else?
Well, I think Trump has accepted the situation on the ground. And he said, we've got to work with Russia to destroy ISIS and al-Qaeda. And in a sense, Turkey has moved closer to Russia in part because he's seen how the winds are blowing.
All right, Joshua, we will continue talking, obviously, about this issue into 2017. Thank you for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzek Rolat. Next, I'll talk with Chad Smith. He's the publisher and editor of Open Letter Books, which focuses on international literature. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. This half hour, I'm joined by Chad Post. He's the publisher and director of Open Letter Books, a nonprofit literary translation press housed at the University of Rochester in New York. He's also the managing editor of 3%, a blog that promotes literature in translation. Chad Post, welcome to Worldviews.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Chad, you do some really interesting work on making foreign language literature available to an English-speaking audience, working with a couple of different publishers and press that you've been involved in and have started. And I want to get to those, but let's just start with the beginning. Your background is in English and psychology, but I'd like to understand kind of what took you down that path of reading foreign literature and wanting to make it available to an English-speaking audience.
Yeah, I think the main thing was, so sure, I did graduate from Michigan State with English and psychology degrees, but the real love of international literature came when I was working at bookstores. I worked at a bookstore in Grand Rapids, Michigan for a number of years, and then in Raleigh, North Carolina at Quail Ridge Books. I had always loved Julio Cortazar, who's an Argentine author who wrote a book called Hopscotch. That was one of my all-time favorite books. But it was at Quail Ridge that I started to try and read more and find more books from especially Latin America. And then I read a ton of Latin American books and then started reading French books and then started reading Norwegian books and Icelandic books and all these other areas because I got very excited about like what was available from these other cultures. And one thing that we did at Quail Ridge that was interesting was that was a moment in time where I started to find two things. One was that there are huge gaps. Like there'd be references by these Latin American authors to other Latin American authors. And so I'd go and try and find their book and they wouldn't be available. They just were not there. They had not been translated. And my Spanish is like, even though I took years of it, is probably worse than a four-year-old. So I never could read books of the type in Spanish of the type that I would like to read. But then the second thing was that we found that like a lot of people just ignored, a lot of customers wouldn't pay attention to books that weren't written in English. And we ended up creating a section that was all international literature and organizing it by region. And our sales more than doubled for those types of books. And just by putting it together, that people sort of went and were like, oh, I'm interested in like Scandinavia. Here's like some Scandinavian books all grouped together that I can look at. So it's kind of those two things sort of got me more interested in the publishing side and the production side. Like, how do these books get chosen? How do they make their way into English? And then most importantly, like, how do they find readers after they are made available? So I ended up working at Dalkey Archive Press initially as an apprentice, and ended up being hired there and worked there as an associate director for a number of years until I left in 2007 to help found Open Letter Books at the University of Rochester.
So, wow, what an interesting path you followed. You went to work at a bookstore. I assume that means you love to read and that you were just a consumer of books. But you particularly had an interest in foreign works. So what drew you to that, and particularly to Latin American works? Was there something in particular, some sort of trip you'd made or some sort of experience you had?
Yeah, it really wasn't a trip at all. It was mostly that I liked books that were experimental is a bad word, but something that was unusual, that did something other than what I had already expected or seen or was used to. And I found, like, through Cortázar in particular, and then through French Olympian writers, that they were doing things with the form of the novel and with the way that you could create a story, a narrative, that was unusual. And I'm very drawn to that. I'm drawn to things that are, like, sort of breaking out of what your expectations are.
So, for example, like what were they doing that was different?
Hopscotch is a decent example because it's broken up into three parts. They're called From the Other Side, From This Side, and From Diverse Sides. And the beginning has a chapter list. And you can read the book as the first two parts straight through, chapters 1 through 75. Or you can read it the way that Julio Cortázar intended you to, where you read like a couple, chapter 1, chapter 2, and then chapter like 95, and then you come back to 3, 4, then to 121, 114, 172, then 6, 7, and you read in like this varied way where as you're getting the main storyline, you're also getting these other things thrown in at you. The Olympian authors from France are really interesting too because they create constraints. So like there's a book, a famous book by Georges Prac called The Void in English that doesn't use the letter E. And the whole book cannot use the letter E one time. So, like, things like that that were like, how else can you tell instead of just like, here's a family, here's their saga, like, what other interesting ways can you tell that? And that sort of opened up then more broadly into, away from like the aesthetic side of things, into what voices are there throughout the world that are adding things. So that if I think about literature as a whole, I'm not just thinking about American writers, thinking about the other voices that exist all over in parts of the world that I obviously never visit or have never experienced. At least there's some, you get something, you get an idea of like that. And it's cool because I think that a lot of international writers are doing things that aren't as codified and commercial as a lot of American writing can be. Like, we have a sort of system here where you want to get published by certain presses, you write a certain way. Everything's kind of, it's not to say that it's not good, and it's not to say that there's not people doing things that are unique, but there is sort of the massive middle part of our writing in America is like down one single path. And all these other countries don't have that. So the voices seem to be unique. They seem to create the idea of a consciousness in a way that's something that's separate, and I like that.
So this is interesting to me, this notion that different cultures maybe, what I'm hearing you say is that there's something rather formulaic about perhaps writing in one particular culture, or at least in American literature.
That sounds so much more negative. I'm suggesting, I'll walk that back a little bit.
But, you know, that perhaps there's something more creative and you use the word aesthetic, aesthetically pleasing perhaps to the eye and ear and imagery when you read different literature. But do you find those same patterns, let's say, in Latin culture or in European culture, different forms of Europe, that you find those same sorts of patterns?
I feel like you start to find those patterns not through the writing that exists in those countries per se, although they're more in a global conversation a lot of times. A lot of like Latin American writers will have read a lot more French writers or a lot more Chinese authors or Japanese authors than I shouldn't paint American writers as being in a negative way. They're really, American writers are fantastic, and there's a ton of really great American writers. So I'm using them as kind of a straw man here. But it is true that a lot of American writers don't read a lot of international literature. Most readers don't read a lot of international literature, whereas in other countries, they're doing that all the time. So there's a lot of conversation that goes on, and that influences the way that they write and talk. Where I think that what you're getting out of like the patterns that you see, a lot of that comes from what's chosen to be translated into English. Because once you hit English, then you're on a much larger global stage. So as big as you can be, except in, you know, cases in China where they have like a much larger population base and people do read a lot of books, until your book is translated in English, you'll have a relatively limited audience. But once you're in English, everyone can read your book. A lot more publishers will pick up on it. So if you're like an Italian author, even once Ferrante is translated into English, she's suddenly translated into 20 other languages and is a global phenomenon. So what publishers have chosen, and we'll stick with Latin America for a second. During like the 80s and early 90s, a lot of the publishing houses in America, what they were looking for was strict magical realism. If a book wasn't like a magical realist Latin American book in which toasters talked and grandmothers came from the dead to provide, you know, inspirational advice, then they just weren't interested. And I think that's where like they started to create this pattern of like, that's what Latin American literature is. It's all this kind of magical realism stuff. And that's not the case at all. And like, there are a lot of people that weren't writing within that. But because the publishing industry in America only does like a small number of books in translation, you have like a sort of recency bias of like what you've seen, that's what you expect it all to be. And I think that that's dangerous. And I think that that's one of the things that led to wanting to work in publishing and starting Open Letter and doing the 3% website, is to try and expand that and say there are myriad voices. Like, it's not all like that. And there's a lot of different things that go on. Some of it's not great. Some of it's spectacular. They're everything in between. But by looking, you get to find unique voices. Otherwise, wouldn't be heard.
Well, which voices are chosen? I mean, how does that process work? You mentioned Ferrante. I mean,
yeah.
You know, who, like you said, has become a global phenomenon. I'm working my way through her books myself. So, but who gets to decide which voices are heard? Because I think that's an important issue. Mm-hmm. And then something along the way, you know, some might suggest that translating works from one language to another, you lose something too, of importance. And so, I mean, I understand it's better to have people read something in translation than not read it at all, right? And I can't go and read something in Spanish or Italian or Chinese, so I need to rely on that that English translation. But what am I missing? Am I missing anything, or is it just as good as we can get? So how do we choose, and then how do we decide which translation to use?
These are two large questions. So let me try, and I'll try and break this down as simply and concretely as possible. In terms of the choosing part, there's a confluence of different actors that work towards getting a book published in translation. So ranging from the original author, who may have an agent or a publisher in their home country, who is then representing that book to a lot of editors throughout the U.S. and U.K. and throughout the world. There's a thing that the Frankfurt Book Fair that just took place is the massive gathering of publishers from all over. It's like 60,000 people come and exchange rights for like a 5-day period in which they're telling you, like, here's the great, like, Brazilian book, here's the book from Malaysia, here's this, here's that. And those people are promoting a particular type, like they're promoting the books that they feel are most best fit with your publishing vision. So like, we don't get pitched books that are like big Scandinavian thrillers. We get pitched books that are like sort of fit into our, what we've designated as our sort of wheelhouse of what types of books we're interested in. But once you have the book, generally, and this is where part of the problem comes in. If you have the book that's untranslated, what we do is we get someone to do a reader's report, if it sounds interesting to us, to do a reader's report on it and then a sample translation. And then if we like what we've read, then we try and figure out whether or not we should go ahead with this book or not. And that can be any number of factors, be it like you know the author personally and feel like they're a good person that you should be supporting and that they do their previous books are really great, you'll like this one, to like, is there grant money available for this book? Is it something that's like 900 pages and you're going to have to pay for all of it and it's probably going to sell 42 copies? Or is it like, there's economic considerations, there's like the aesthetic considerations, there's sort of this personal consideration of like, who do you want to work with, who does this make sense? And there's also within that, like, who the translator is. And this is where I think that, to segue into the other side of your question, people talk about the loss in translation thing a lot. And I feel like it's almost to the point where it's like, it's the term outsizes what it actually indicates. Like, what is really lost is usually pretty minor when you're dealing with a really good translator. And that might be the key part to this, is that there's been, at points in time, there are translators like Constance Garnett, who translated all these Russian books back in like the early 1900s. All the great Russian works that we know are primarily known through her translations. I think she did like 120 books, like, I mean, a significant thing. But she translated the books into more of like a Victorian sort of garden party tone. So rather than being like the original Russian writing, she sort of converted them into the style of the day, which was a Victorian sort of lush writing style. And in that case, you can say, like, yes, there's something that is lost. We've lost, like, the voice. And I think or the style. And that's the part that I'm most concerned with, is that if the translator can find the style and represent it, then the book is getting through. Like, Borges, the Argentine writer, always used to say that, like, you're not translating the words, you're translating the spirit. And what you want is that spirit. And I in my classes that I teach, I always use style as, like, the shorthand for that there's something that makes the original work unique and makes the voice work, makes the plot work, makes everything works because there's something unique about how it's written. And it's a translator's job to capture that and replicate that. Are there jokes that are not going to work directly? Sure. But, like, there's things that you can gain back by finding a different sort of joke or finding a different way to approach it. But if you get that main consciousness, the style down, that book sort of works. And once you start working on it in English as an editor, you can help kind of refine it until it is its own sort of entity that's not exactly the same. I argue against, like, the primacy of the original, in the sense that, like, the original is not, it doesn't have to be just like that. It's not perfect as the original. Nothing's absolutely perfect. So we're finding a new version. With a lot of, like, new things have started happening at universities where they're training a lot of students to be attuned to being a literary translator. And the ones who are very talented take that learning and are very conscious and are very good at it. I think we have a great crop, like there's really great translators that have been around for years, but over the past, like, 20 years, there's more and more young people that are getting in that are working at a high, high level and are aware of a lot of these different points. And I think that that's important.
Yeah, I was going to ask this question about translators and training translators. I think that's a really interesting part of this subject. Well, just very quickly as we end, you mentioned a couple of books, Hopscotch and The Void, which I'm going to pick up for sure. But if there's, you know, if there are a couple of things that are really must reads from your perspective, what would you suggest? What are your favorite books?
That's funny. I'm all fixated on our books right now because in publishing you read like 9 months ahead. So I'll just recommend one that's coming out in the spring that's called Invented Part by Rodrigo Frazan. And he's an Argentine Spanish writer. And this is a giant book that might well be the best book we've published ever.
All right, Chad, thank you so much for being with us. It's such a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you sharing.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Chad Post, the publisher and editor of Open Letter Books in Rochester, New York. You can find more information online at kgou.org and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is part of a partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produced the show, and Brian Hartzinski edited this interview. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.